Nirvati Paskachyati Satarani Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavamsta Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raghunatham Vikram Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vichamcha Panchkalpa Chubhischa Kripa Sindhavya Vata Parijanam Pavanevya Vaishnavya Namo Namaha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. May 26, 2021, in Hawaii over the internet, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 25. The descriptions of the characteristics of Ping Pranjana, text 45. Saptapari Krita Dwara.
Saptapari Krita Dwara.
Purastasyas Tudveda. Krita Vishaya Gatyartam.
Krita Vishaya Gatyartam.
Tasyanya Kashchaneshvaraha.
Tasyanya Kashchaneshvaraha.
Sapta.
Sapta.
Seven.
Seven.
Upari.
Upari.
Up.
Up.
Kritaha.
Kritaha.
Made.
Made.
Dwaraha.
Dwaraha.
Gates.
Gates.
Puraha.
Puraha.
Of the city.
Of the city.
Tasyaha.
Tasyaha.
That.
Yes.
Two.
Two.
Then.
Then.
Dwe.
Dwe.
Two.
Two.
Adaha.
Adaha.
Down.
Down.
Pritak.
Pritak.
Different.
Different.
Vishaya.
Vishaya.
Two places.
Two places.
Gati artam.
Gati artam.
Forgoing.
Forgoing.
Tasyam.
Tasyam.
In that city.
In that city.
Yaha.
Yaha.
One who.
One who.
Kashchana.
Kashchana.
Whoever.
Whoever.
Ishwaraha.
Ishwaraha.
Governor.
Governor.
Srila Prabhupada's translation. Of the nine gates in that city, seven were on the surface and two were subterranean. A total of nine doors were constructed, and these led to different places. All the gates were used by the city's governor. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The seven gates of the body that are situated upward are the two eyes, two nostrils, two ears, and one mouth. The two subterranean gates are the rectum and the genitals. The king or the ruler of the body, who is a living entity, uses all these doors to enjoy different types of material pleasures. The system of opening different gates to different places is still evident in old Indian cities. Formerly, a capital was surrounded by walls, and one passed through various gates to go to various cities or towards specific directions. In Old Delhi, there are still remnants of surrounding walls and various gates, known as the Kashmiri Gate, the Lahori Gate, etc. Similarly, in Ahmedabad, there is a Delhi Gate. The point of this simile is that the living entity wants to enjoy different types of material opulences, and to this end, nature has given him various holes in his body that he can utilize for sense enjoyment. Saptapadi Krita Dwara Puras Tasyas Tudre Ata Krita Vishaya Gatyartam Tasyam Ya Kashchaneshvaraha. At the nine gates in that city, seven were on the surface and two were subterranean. A total of nine doors were constructed, and these led to different places. All the gates were used by the city's governor. All right. So this is the metaphor of the body as city, and with the different apertures in the body being gates to go out of the city. And they take us to different places, just like Prabhupada's talking about walled cities in India that had various gates. Of course, even in modern cities that don't have walls, because there's not much point in having walled cities when there's airplanes, there are still different highways that lead out of different parts of the city and go to various destinations. So there is a highway that's going to go north and one that goes south, and one that goes east and one that goes west, or to different places like that. And as you drive, there's different signs to go to different locations. So this reminds me a little bit of game shows, if any of you ever saw when I was younger. I used to watch sometimes game shows on TV where you would have, you know, several doors and you'd pick, I want to pick door number 2, and I want to pick door number 3, and there were different prizes or something behind the doors. My mother had a favorite story, which some of you may be familiar with, called The Lady or the Tiger. So The Lady or the Tiger, it was about a man who was in love with a princess, and the king did not want him to marry his daughter. But the princess was also in love with the man, so this was a little difficult. So the man was put in a stadium, and behind one door was the princess, and behind another door was a very hungry tiger. And so the king was leaving this up to fate, whether this young man would marry his daughter or be devoured by the tiger, depending on which door he opened. It's a short story, and the end of the story is he opened the door, and and you don't find out in the story whether he opened the door to the lady or he opened the door to the tiger. But this concept of having different gateways that take us to different places is certainly there in any kind of city. So I thought about how in this world we have different places to go to, and different portals and different doors, and then about also the gates of the body, and to choose which door we want to go to and to which destination we want to go, and not just to pick blindly like in these game shows where you don't know where you're going. So in this world, there's many places we can go for illusory enjoyment. We can, just like another example would be, I mean, this is not unknown. The examples I gave previously were unknown. And then, of course, Prabhupada's talking about the known examples, the different gates in a walled city going different places. And I gave the examples of different highways going different places. Those are known. Other known examples, you know, like you go to a mall, and there's so many different shops you can shop in. You can shop in the electronic shop. You can shop in the clothing shop. And then you have 10 different clothing shops you can shop in. And at least in American malls, there's usually a food court. So there's, you know, 15, 20 different restaurants you can go to. In a mall in Moscow, we have our Prasadam food court as well. And in many of these malls, there's a cinema complex. And there's 10 different movies you can go to see. So it's like that in this world, that there are so many different places we can go to for illusion. We can go to so many different planets for different kinds of illusion on different planets. Many of these planets are described in the Srimad Bhagavatam, especially in the fifth canto. All the different parts of Jambudvip, what incarnation of the Lord they worship there, even the subterranean heavenly planets, and then of course we have our earth planet, and then you have the hellish planets, or the description of Brihad Bhagavatamrita, where Gopakumar, he's just going up to all these different planets where there's different kinds of enjoyment. And we can try, you know, just like people try, let me try eating at this restaurant, let me try eating Chinese food, let me try eating Italian food. And I'm sure I've said this before in class, but some years ago, I was on an airplane, Turkish Airways, and it was before the plane took off. So they had, you know how they have a screen, a movie screen in airplanes. So they were showing an advertisement for their airline, which was interesting because we were already sitting in the plane of the airline. Anyway, they're advertising all the different places you can go on their airline, and they had some, I'm assuming, famous sports people. I have no idea who they were, but anyway, I'm assuming they were famous. And they're, in this commercial, going on Turkish Airlines to different places of the world, and most of the places they were going to, I have already been to. So I'm looking at this thinking, okay, I went there, and I went there, and I went there, and I went there. And I'm sitting in my seat thinking, you know, there's no more places I want to go to on this planet. I thought, I guess now I have to go to other planets. So people are trying different things. You know, they're going to go to the mountains in Switzerland, or they're going to, or the mountains in New Zealand, or they're going to go to the ocean in Tahiti, or the ocean in Hawaii, or, you know, something. They're going to see the multicolored mountains in China, or the multicolored skies in Norway and Iceland in the winter, and try to get different tastes of enjoyment, or they're going to go to hear different things, or smell different things. And really the problem is that all of these places are, as Prahlad Maharaj said, chewing the chewed. And one of my big examples of that was when I went to China, and they made a lot of different preparations out of sticky rice. Well, they would take sticky rice, and by adding different spices and different things in it, it would look like a very different prep, but it almost always tasted exactly the same, although it looked very, very different. Prabhupada gives the example of a prostitute who changes her clothes. He often gives that example. So it's the same person, but she looks different in different kinds of clothes. But anyway, there's all these different places. Now, also in the material world, there's different places one can go for spiritual enlightenment. And I really thought about this concept of dwara, gates. Okay, dwara, that's why it's called dwaraka, because it has so many gates. So dwara, gates, to go to different places. And vishaya, to places. Vishaya also means like your shelter, where you're headed to. That we also have gates in this world to go to real enjoyment. And I thought a lot about the Sanskrit word tirtha. So a tirtha could be roughly translated as a portal, as a door, as some sort of a gate. A tirtha literally means a place where a river becomes narrow, and the literal English word for that is a strait, S-T-R-A-I-T. The city Detroit is the French word for the strait. It's where the Detroit River becomes very narrow and you can easily cross over. So straits are very important. Again, S-T-R-A-I-T. A strait is very important because if you're traveling, and especially if there's no bridges, you want to take your boat over the most narrow area of the river. Which is making me think about in World War II, D-Day, how in the English Channel, the narrowest part is called the Pas-de-Calais. And naturally, the Germans assumed that the Allies would enter continental Europe and try to defeat them at the Pas-de-Calais. That's the most logical place because that's the most narrow. So in order to have a surprise attack, the Allies instead landed in Normandy, but they put fake tanks and fake boats at the Pas-de-Calais. So the Germans would be fooled because it was, again, it was the logical place to cross. So tirthas are like that. They're a place where crossing is easy. Just like, what is a door? What is a gate? It's a place where you can easily have ingress and egress into and out of a place. I mean, I suppose you could knock down a wall if you wanted to get out of a place. You know, you could have an explosion and blow up your place. But generally, to get out, in and out, there's a door. There's a portal, there's a gate, there's a road, there's something like that, right? Just like, again, if you're going to travel on the highways and there's an exit to get on the highway, I mean, you could do it another way. You could drive an off-road vehicle and you could, you know, try to go over the side of the road. But generally, you're going to go through the normal channels. So tirthas are like that. Tirthas are their gates, their passageways. Now, they're passageways to where? Unlike to illusory enjoyment, a tirtha is a passageway to spirituality, to a real place. You know, the gates in the world to illusion, it's like, you know, again, like a cinemaplex where a person can go to 10 different movies. They can go to, you know, a horror movie, they can go to a romantic movie, they can go to whatever, a shoot 'em up movie. But it's all illusion. Or these, you know, food complex, you can have, you know, this kind of dead animal, or that kind of dead animal, like that, or this sort of useless toy and that sort of useless clothing. But the tirthas take one to something genuine. And they transport one in consciousness. Now, they can also literally transport one. Just like Srila Prabhupada writes about yogis who know how to travel throughout the universe in the Ganges, that they can dip in one place in the Ganges and they come out in another place. Right? They know how to use the Ganges as like a highway with exits of some sort that they can know how to travel it. Or there's another mystic power where they can go anywhere on the rays of the sunshine. I mean, that's pretty far out. So there's these, you could say, portals in the universe to different parts of the universe, and there's also portals in the universe as like a place you can go to connect with Lord Shiva. There's a place we just had, Nisinga Chaturdasi, and Dear Krishna Maharaj was giving a class, was speaking about Ahovalam, and he made the observation that in Ahovalam, it may or may not be the exact place where the Lord appeared. But if you go there because the consciousness of the people there is absorbed in the pastimes of Lord Nisinga, that therefore you can actually enter that place by going there. So what does that mean? It's just like many of us are in a place that was just an ordinary place. Right, like I'm right now in Hillsboro, North Carolina. This was an ordinary place. But by people coming here with a consciousness of Radha and Krishna in Vrindavan and installing deities of Radha and Krishna, then coming here becomes a tirtha or a portal to Vrindavan. So that one being in this place can have the right consciousness and be transported to Vrindavan. It's like a consciousness transport. Again, it's like a particular kind of gate. So some of these are eternally in the material world. And these are called, not exactly tirthas, but dhamas. So there are places in the material world that are eternally spiritual. And the best analogy we have for that, of course it's not eternal, but is an embassy. So even if you're in Moscow, when you walk in the American embassy, you're in America. Of course, it's, again, that's temporary. But we have some idea from this analogy that there are places that are ostensibly in the material world, but are not actually. And of course, we have descriptions of the destruction of the material world where these places remain as they are. We have the description of Brihad Bhagavatamrita, where Gopakumar, many lifetimes of Lord Brahma goes by, the universe is created and destroyed, and still he sees that the Dham remains as the Dham. So those are not exactly portals, they're not exactly gates. They're a place where the spiritual world itself is there. If one has the proper consciousness, if one knows how to access it. If one has premanjana charita bhakti vilochanena santasa daiva hridayeshu vilokananti. If one has eyes smeared with love, one goes to those places and one experiences them as they actually are. Whereas if one doesn't have the proper consciousness, one feels something. Like Prabhupada writes in Nectar Devotion that even a non-devotee will feel something upon entering Vrindavan. They'll know there was something going on there, but they won't necessarily be able to really understand it or fully access it. And then you have the Tirthas. So in the Tirthas, those are places that are temporary, and they are established. They may be for the whole duration of the material world. And these are places that are established by the Lord or established by great devotees. Some exist for the duration of the universe. Some exist for the duration of Lord Brahma's day. Some may exist just for a few years, where in that place you can access a higher realm of real consciousness. You can find something that's not illusory. You can find something that's authentic. You can find your real self. And the concept of having these sort of places is there in every human society. So in most human societies, this is done through erection of buildings that are established as places of worship and consecrated as places of worship. But there are also sometimes places in nature where humans recognize that a particular place of nature is especially fruitful for having a tirtha or a connection to the divine. Now, in some cases, these places are really just connection with higher aspects of illusion, like they may be places of connection with the demigods or places of connection with the spirits of flora and fauna in a particular area. So that may also be there. But that's also recognized. That's like we read in the Bhagavatam about connection with some of the different planets and some of the different entities. And Sataputra Prabhu, my late godbrother, has written about this and talked about the stories in every culture of someone who just, you know, they fall asleep against a particular tree and they wake up in a different part of the universe. So there's definitely, and we were talking about the Ganges and the rays of the sun, that you can go to different parts of the universe. So there's portals to go to different levels of illusion, and sometimes human beings set up as a system of worship something as a sacred place that really is just a portal to another realm of illusion. It's not always a portal to ultimate reality. At the same time, in every human society, there's some concept of sacred space. And we can set up a tirtha in our own home, in our own room. There's a carpenter or handyman who does a lot of work for the devotees here. And I remember him saying to me, well, I noticed that for each of you Hare Krishnas, you all have some kind of a shrine set up in your home or in your room. So this is, we're establishing our place as a tirtha. And an analogy that I make for this is not only of a gate, but of like Wi-Fi. You know, when you put a Wi-Fi device, you put a router, you put a modem in your space, then you can connect to people in other places. You know, and if you're looking for a spot or for your phone, right? You're traveling someplace with your phone. And some places it gets a signal and some places it doesn't. So the places it gets a signal are acting like a tirtha. They're acting like a portal on a subtle level. So let's look now at the body. So in the body, we also have these different gates. And here in this Puranjana story, Puranjana is going to be using these gates. We're going to have this description of each of the gates, that each of the gates have a particular type of enjoyment connected with it. There's some enjoyment even in evacuating, right? After we've digested and we evacuate the waste, there's some pleasure in that. So there's some pleasure in eating, and there's some pleasure in hearing and tasting and so forth. And it's a different kind of pleasure. The pleasure we get from hearing beautiful music is not the same as the pleasure we get from seeing a sunset or a beautiful animal or person, and that's not the same pleasure that we get, you know, from smelling something. I mean, it's a different type of pleasure. But it's all illusion. We are simply witnessing some contact between the bodily senses and their object, which our mind is interpreting as favorable or unfavorable. And whether we interpret something as favorable or unfavorable depends on two things. It depends on what kind of body we have and what's necessary for the upkeep of the body. Just like Srila Prabhupada makes the example all the time of the pigs who want to eat stool but will not eat halva. I don't know if pigs actually don't eat halva, but I'm sure the Prabhupada had some experience of trying to give a pig halva and the pig not being interested. And whereas human beings, I mean, unless they're psychotic, do not eat stool. You know, we have a natural revulsion. The smell of stool naturally revolts us because eating our stool will make us ill. It's things that the body is supposed to discard and not take in. But there are many creatures that eat stool. I mean, dogs will also eat stool. And then, of course, there are many insects that eat stool, bacteria. And there's even the dung beetles and so many creatures for whom what's rejectable by us is acceptable to them. Or animals that eat wood, you know, like termites or beavers, that they actually can digest wood. Whereas if we tried to eat wood, it would make us very sick. So a lot of what's considered pleasure in terms of each of these gates is very much dependent on the particular type of body that we have and what is necessary or helpful for the sustenance of that body. Of course, it's not exactly that because we have a particular body, we find certain things pleasurable. But as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, we get senses grouped around the mind when we get each body. But it's more a sense of what do we already find pleasurable? We get a particular body that needs that type of pleasure for its sustenance. So, you know, if a person is attracted to old meat, I read something from some devotees some time back that meat eaters are really not so much like tigers and more like vultures. You know, humans don't eat like raw meat. They eat putrefied meat. They're more like scavengers. So if a person develops a taste for a particular thing, then they get a particular type of body that fits that taste. Just like I read an article recently about genders and how that mammals have two defined genders. I mean, obviously there's some variation even in mammals. There are some things that occur in nature where there's like intersex and different things like that. But there's two defined genders for reproduction. Whereas in non-mammalian species, sometimes it's not like that. Sometimes the genders are more fluid. There's a type of lizard that there's only females. They reproduce without males. There's, you know, certain fish that can turn from female to male and male to female, and, you know, hermaphrodite worms and things like that. So if people have desires like that, then they get a corresponding body. It's not that because we have a particular type of body, therefore we have a particular type of desires. It's more because we have a particular type of desires, therefore we get a particular type of body. So anyway, what's considered pleasurable through these gates depends upon what is necessary to sustain that particular type of body. And it also depends, and of course this is very related, to what combination of the modes of nature the living entity is attracted to. And because each type of body is a combination of the different modes, so these are two different ways of looking at the similar thing. So if a person is very much attracted to the mode of goodness, to sattva-gun, then they'll find attractive various sense pleasures in sattva-gun. And if they're attracted to rajagun, they'll be attracted to sense pleasures in rajagun, sense and mental pleasures, and so forth, or combinations. You know, the 8,400,000 species are that there's three modes, and 3 times 3 is 9, and 9 times 9 is 81, and then you have the original three, so you get 84, so you get 8,400,000. And this is, you know, if you have three colors, we have the three primary colors, and you mix them together, and you get all different shades and tints and hues of different colors. And so this is the nature of going out of the gates of the body for enjoyment. So again, we say one man's food is another man's poison. That what the living entity is traveling out of their ear gate, and, you know, travel out of your ear gate, and the music I like is not going to be the music that you like. You know, we have different samskaras, we have different modes of nature, we have different experiences and different lifetimes. And I tell the story of how at the Woodstock Festival, devotees are there having a Rath Yatra through the festival, and we passed this group of people dressed all in black that were listening to something I assume they considered music, but it sounded to me like animals growling, growling and howling. And I just like, wow, it sounds like noises coming from hell. So, but they were very much enjoying listening to that. So that's the nature of illusory enjoyment. The nature of illusory enjoyment is based on the particular combination of the modes of nature. It's based on the particular body that one has. It's not, therefore, any kind of absolute enjoyment or real enjoyment. You cannot say such a thing is actually pleasurable. Like, you just can't say that. You can't say cheesecake is pleasurable. Cheesecake is pleasurable to some people, some types of beings, in some circumstances, in some types of body. Or if you're going to say, you know, Mozart is pleasurable. Again, that depends who you are. So there's no standard of this is pleasurable and this is not pleasurable. It's a very relative kind of thing. I mean, we could say that from a spiritual perspective, things in sattva-guna are actually more pleasurable than things in tamaguna. But on the other hand, like Prabhupada would say, wet stool, dry stool. It's just different varieties of false ego and different varieties of illusion, different varieties of identification with earth, water, fire, air, ether. So none of it is satisfying to the self. And we find that Paranjana, of course, he's not satisfied in the city of nine gates with this illusion. Now, it's also very possible with the bodily gates to use the bodily gates not for illusion, but to use the bodily gates for service. Just like in this world, we have highways that take us and gates and to take us to different illusory places. We also have tirthas that take us to spiritual places. Now, what's interesting in the body is that the very same gates that take us to illusory places can also take us to spiritual places. I mean, of course, we have, in addition to the gross gates, we have the subtle aspects of the body, the different chakras, which also each represent a different type of enjoyment. But those are just subtle types of enjoyment. They're not spiritual. It's not that if you're using the heart chakra, the anahata, that you're going to be experiencing something that's any more spiritual than using your nose. I mean, and one is gross matter and one is subtle matter. But in each case, you're still within this world of illusion. So although it is a system within the body to move the soul through the life airs, and of course Krishna explains this in the 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita and the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that one can take the life air through the chakras and can use not one of these ordinary gates, not one of these nine gates, but one can use these subtle entrances. And one can leave the body through the Sahasrara chakra, or one can also leave through the Agya chakra, and one can go to higher realms of more subtle enjoyment, or one can even go, as Krishna is explaining in the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that one can even go to the spiritual world through those gates rather than through using the ordinary, the physical gates of the eyes and the ears and the nose and the rectum and so forth. However, one can also use all of these bodily gates to go to the spiritual world. Something like we can take an ordinary place in this world, a place that's not a dham, an ordinary place, and we can turn it into a tirtha. We can turn it into a portal to go to the spiritual. And the main evidence for this is in the Bhagavatam in 9.4, 18 through 20, about Maharaj Ambarish, and a very famous verse that Srila Prabhupada quotes a lot. So Maharaj Ambarish always engaged his mind in meditating upon the lotus feet of Krishna, his words in describing the glories of the Lord, his hands in cleansing the Lord's temple, and his ears in hearing the words spoken by Krishna or about Krishna. He engaged his eyes in seeing the deity of Krishna, Krishna's temples and Krishna's places like Mathura and Vrindavan. He engaged his sense of touch in touching the bodies of the Lord's devotees. He engaged his sense of smell in smelling the fragrance of tulasi offered to the Lord. And he engaged his tongue in tasting the Lord's prasad. He engaged his legs in walking to the holy places and temples of the Lord, his head in bowing down before the Lord, and all his desires and serving the Lord 24 hours a day. Indeed, Maharaj Ambarish never desired anything for his own sense gratification. He engaged all his senses in devotional service and various engagement related to the Lord. This is the way to increase attachment for the Lord and be completely free from all material desires. Of course, we have something quite similar in Rupa Goswami's verse, Vacho Vegam, Manasakrota Vegam, Jiva Vegam, Udur Pasta Vegam, where Srila Prabhupada in his purport writes about how we can use each of our senses, each of our inclinations, even things like lust and anger, we can use in the service of the Lord. So that's amazing. That's seeing the body not as a city with nine gates for enjoyment, but as a temple. Again, it's creating a tirtha out of the body. So instead of seeing the body like a big shopping mall, where, you know, there's all different kinds of stores to purchase things, there's all different kinds of restaurants, there's all different kinds of movies, instead of seeing the body like that, oh, I have a playground where I can use this body to fulfill my illusory desires, we see the body as a tirtha. Now, the thing is that the body is actually a temple. It's both, isn't it? It's a place for, this is Prabhupada said, the mystery of the material creation, that this body and mind is a place to fulfill illusory desires separate from the Lord, but it's also, right, Ishwara Sarvabhutanam Rajeshaya Janatistai Brahmayan Sarvabhutani Yantra Rudani Mayaya. Krishna says, I am in everyone's heart. And he says this frequently. The Lord is in the heart. In fact, the main meditation of the yogis who try to use the senses and the chakras and the life airs to find the Lord is that the Lord is in the heart. Well, if the Lord is in the heart, then the body is a temple. The body is a tirtha. And this concept of, you know, marking the body with tilak and saying the names of the Lord is that we then establish the body as a tirtha. We establish, we recognize. Yes, just like in our room, Krishna's already in our room. He's in every atom in our room. He's in the air. He's in the light. But we establish an altar. And we put a picture. We put the deity. And we establish this room, this house, is a tirtha. So in the same way, in our body, we recognize, oh, there's the Lord in my heart. Therefore, in my heart is a shrine. And I love the lecture in Geneva where Srila Prabhupada says, chanting Hare Krishna means that you establish a diamond throne in the heart. And you seat Krishna there. And you bathe him with Ganga and Jamuna water. And you dress him and you ornament him. And in that way, he says, wherever you go becomes a tirtha. So what happens when we recognize our body as a temple is that we become a walking tirtha. Just like, you know, we talk about you have a Wi-Fi modem in your room, you can have, if your phone has a data connection, you can set up your phone as a mobile modem, as a mobile hotspot that other people can connect to. So when we set up our body, when we recognize our body as a tirtha, when we use our body as a tirtha, then other people can access the spiritual realm through us. We become a portal. And of course, this was true with Srila Prabhupada, that Srila Prabhupada and persons of his caliber, right? This is said about Vidura, saints of your caliber. Wherever you go becomes a tirtha. Wherever you go becomes a portal. So this is where we want to go. You know, we can look at the body and see, ah, oh, you know, this body is full of mucus, bile, and air. His body is packed up with stool and urine and pus and blood. And, you know, if we just get some little cut or something where you see the inside of the body. So it's not very attractive at all, like, or that play Liquid Beauty where the woman put aside the man's seductions by keeping her stool and vomit for some time. So you can see so we can see the body like that. We can see that this body is some disgusting mess. We can see that the mind is a disgusting mess. That's okay. That's certainly accurate. But we can also see that this body and this mind is glorious. We can see the, what does it say in the Bible? Fearfully and wonderfully made. We can also see the body as we see the universe. We can see that this body is an incredible city made by the Lord, an intricate city, far more intricate than any city ever made by any human beings. Far more wondrous, made up of living cells, and none of which are understood even by the combined effort of the most intelligent human beings on the planet studying for thousands of years. They don't understand all the workings of the body, what to speak of all the workings of the mind. And this wonderful, glorious, incredible, I mean, it's self-healing. That's amazing, isn't it? Isn't that amazing? The body can self-heal. Incredible. The mind can self-heal. And this is designed to be a wonderful temple, a wonderful tirtha, where we find the reality, where we connect with the reality. And this is particularly true, of course, of the human body. That in the bodies lower than humans, although the Lord is there and it's their bodies are a temple, it's pretty hard for a wolf, you know, or a poison ivy plant, or a fly, to understand that their body is wonderful, that their body and mind is amazing. It's a tirtha, the Lord is there. And they can use that body and mind for spirituality. But we can understand that. So we could say that we're not really asking which door. We can go through all of these doors. If we go through them with the proper consciousness, then we will reach the actual destination. And what's interesting about that is that once we use this body and mind for its actual destination, then the analogy is given that wood is the source of fire, but the fire burns up the wood. So this human body and human mind is the source of our entrance into the transcendence, but then taking up the path of transcendence finishes the subtle body. And once one achieves bhava, one is no longer on the platform of the mind, and ultimately destroys the gross body. Trakta deham punarjanma naitimam eti sojana. That once we have spiritualized our desires and spiritualized our destinations, we no longer need another one of these bodies for these different varieties of illusory enjoyment. So, questions, comments, additions, subtractions?
Crossing my mind, we're talking about the senses, and we have all these various senses for enjoying. I was thinking that the senses are not their ability to enjoy, but at least in the human form, and probably others as well, it's not independent of the mind. It's like, for example, if you're eating, I think I've given this kind of gross example before, but if you're eating some. Even prasadams are wonderful. Prasadam tastes delicious. It's a nice pakora with chutney, nice tomato chutney on it, and we're enjoying it. But one night I say, you weren't supposed to eat that one. That chutney that you're using, there's a cockroach that got blended up in the, in the blender when we were making it, that we were supposed to throw that one out. But what tasted delicious immediately, you just couldn't. Even though it tastes the same, you couldn't. There's no enjoyment. Or if you're just, you know, you're eating some wonderful food, and all of a sudden you hear about some horrible thing that happened to someone, and your mind goes in a whole different place. You can't enjoy what you were enjoying before. So it seems like that, you know, the senses, they go, and there's the mind. In fact, there's that verse that says. Chinta prangani sangani vijayate sabindriyanam kritim. That Rupa Goswami talks about that when when Krishna dances in the heart, then all the senses become inert. So anyway, that thought was crossing my mind.
Yeah, all concepts of pleasure and pain are actually in the mind. The Avanti Brahman says this in the Bhagavatam. And this is for several reasons. Again, because we are in different modes of nature, so my pleasure is your suffering, and my suffering is your pleasure. You know, what I consider, like, I find spicy food to be simply pain, and other people find it to be pleasurable. You know, it's the same thing. And yeah, it's also, if the mind is very happy, then suffering things will not bother you, and if the mind is very distressed, then pleasurable things will not give you any pleasure. You know, even things you normally find pleasurable will not be a source of pleasure if you're in a lot of anxiety. And if you're very peaceful and very happy, things that would normally bother you would not bother you. So yeah, the things in and of themselves are not pleasurable or painful. Prabhupada would always give the example, it took me years to understand this, that water in the summer is pleasurable but in the winter is not pleasurable. Like what's he trying to say? And what he's saying is that, you know, taking a cool bath is not pleasurable or painful in and of itself. It's, we're thinking this particular thing is pleasurable, this, but it's not. It depends on our mind. It depends on our particular modes. It depends on our particular taste. It's all relative and it's all illusory. Whereas real pleasure is real pleasure. Real spiritual pleasure is actually real spiritual pleasure. It's not conditional, it's not relative, it's not dependent on this or that. It stands in and of itself as real pleasure.
Nice point.
Thank you.
Well, I have a question.
Yes.
But there is a general consensus about what is pleasurable and what is painful, what's good, what's bad. You know, for instance...
Is there?
Everybody knows to murder somebody is not good.
Everybody?
Everybody. Isn't that the general consensus? The same with, you know, like, why do we have advertisements? All the pretty girls.
Okay, well, if everybody knew that murdering somebody was bad, then no murder would ever happen.
No, do the murderers think that that's good?
Some of them, I would assume, do.
Yeah.
I would assume that some of them think it's very good. I mean, there are some people who murder for fun. Prabhupada talks about this, they just murder random people that they don't even know. Prabhupada talks about this as far as the perversion of the ghastly rasa. And he talked about how he was somewhere and he saw this man slaughtering chickens. And the father was there slaughtering these chickens and he was taking pleasure in the fact that the chickens run around even after their heads are removed. And his son was crying, and the father was rebuking his son and saying, "Why are you crying? This is fun." And Prabhupada said, they're trying to enjoy the ghastly humor. We enjoy the real ghastly humor, Prabhupada said, with Nisingadev. But yeah, there are people who think death and killing is enjoyable.
But aren't those perversions? Most everyone would agree that those are perversions. The general understanding there is...
Well, the general understanding is not necessarily that murder is not enjoyable. The general understanding is that murder is not socially acceptable or socially wanted. And that murder is going to cause harm in the society. I don't know if there's a consensus that murder is not enjoyable. If there was a consensus that murder is not enjoyable, or that... let's not call it murder, that one human being killing another human being is not enjoyable, then why is there war? Why is there, you know, so much entertainment involved in one human being killing another? At least in fantasy. So much. There's so many video games where you're in a fantasy that you're killing other humans. And there are so many movies and books about humans killing other humans. I mean, it's actually quite interesting that, you know, some people think that those who love being in the military and those who love fighting in the military, that there must be perverts. That anyone who fights in the military must hate killing other human beings. But that's not actually true. I mean, we have that, the pastime with Krishna and Balaram and Jarasandhar, where there are rivers of blood and parts of bodies floating in the rivers of blood. And Prabhupada said that, you know, the heroes would find this delightful. So, you know, Krishna says, happy are the Kshatriyas to whom such fighting opportunities come unsought, opening for them the doors of the heavenly kingdom. There are classes of people who delight in fighting and killing. Some are criminals, but some are Kshatriyas. Some of them are warriors. And they're a high class in society. These are not the real Kshatriyas who go out and kill other human beings to establish the peace. They're considered very exalted members of society. And would you think they hate doing what they're doing? No, they like doing what they're doing. Just like I like doing my work. There's certain work that I enjoy doing. It gives me pleasure to do certain types of work. There's certain work that's suitable for my nature. So there are people for whom that type of work is pleasurable. And, you know, if we're going to call it murder and we put it in the category of criminality, but even there are criminals, I'm sure, who enjoy murdering. And there are definitely warriors who enjoy killing for righteous reasons. So to say that a human being killing another human being is not pleasurable, I don't know if that's true.
In the news, there was one man that just killed a black man, and then when he was caught and turned in, he said, "Oh, I thought I was doing society a good thing, a service, to get rid of another black person."
Yeah.
I mean, he really thought like that.
Yeah.
Like this was a good thing.
But I mean, if there wasn't some concept in many of us of this, the whole violent entertainment industry would be finished tomorrow. So there's a huge entertainment industry that thrives on fantasy violence. It thrives on our identifying with violence that for various reasons we would not commit ourselves. You know, but if people weren't enjoying it, that industry would, if you had only a tiny fraction of people that enjoyed, that took pleasure in violence, that industry would be over. And I think it's a huge industry. Probably a multi-billion dollar industry in the world between games and movies and books. And
movies are based on revenge and getting, you know, the villains, right? And we enjoy seeing them get, you know, sometimes a ghastly.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I really like the idea that you presented about established churches and temples being portals. And really liked, you know, Vishnujanaswamy was in Austin, Texas, and he was telling people on the street, he was, it was that time when he and a few other sannyasis were turned out of the movement for a short time, and he was telling people, if you bring me to your home, I'll turn it into a temple, you know, I'll show you how to make a temple. So you, but I really like the idea of turning yourself into a tirtha and a portal, you know, this idea of tirthas and portals. That's really interesting. I never thought of that before.
Yeah, that's really cool, isn't it? You know, it's just, I mean, it's stated in the Bhagavatam, right? That persons who meet your good self, wherever you go, you're a tirtha. And Prabhupada talked about us doing that. That if we meditate on the Lord in our heart and meditate on serving the Lord in our heart, wherever we go, we're a tirtha. And, yeah, we become a portal. It's kind of like what Srila Prabhupada said to my father when my father said, I come to the temple because I love my daughter and son-in-law. And Prabhupada said, they are loving Krishna. Chanting and dancing are symptoms of loving Krishna. So they are loving Krishna, and you are loving them. So two things that are equal to the same thing are equal to each other. And yeah, when we recognize the world for what it is in the divine aspect, then we have this connection we use the same gates, you know, the same things, but they become a connection to the reality. It's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. All right, I'm actually supposed to go to a birthday party of one of the senior devotees here. It actually started an hour ago, and I told them I'd be late because I give the class, but I should get going and go to honor this Vaishnavi. So thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.